Welcome to the second half of Dharma Night. And what we've been looking at, for those of you who haven't been coming to Dharma Night the past few weeks, we've been looking at figures of enlightenment. So we're all very used to the quite familiar figure of a Buddha figure. Okay, so we don't have to go to a Buddhist centre to see a Buddha figure, do we? They're in all the shops, from the trashiest gift shop to really expensive antique shops and everywhere in between. They're on t-shirts and everything. So we're very used to the Buddha figure, and we know that the Buddha was the founder of the Buddhist religion. And we may have seen other figures, other Buddhist figures. We might not know what they mean. So this is what we're doing. We're exploring the facets of enlightenment, which sort of radiate in many, many different forms from this original Buddha figure, the historical Buddha, who then became a more universal symbol of Buddhahood. So that's what we've been doing. We've looked at a few different figures, and I'm going to be looking at a very particular figure. Well, I say figure, but actually it's a sort of whole a set of female figures that we're going to look at today. We'll be introducing her. And within that, I also want to talk about what it might be like for us as Westerners to be, for those of us who are born and brought up in the West, to encounter what might be quite representations that might be quite alien to our visual language. So a lot of these Buddha figures are represented in Indian, Chinese, Tibetan art forms, and that's a very, very different set of aesthetic rules and symbolism to that which we're used to in the West, and that really does shape our minds. So it can be very exciting seeing these depictions if we're looking at them visually, but also we can not know how to read it, and we can maybe not have an immediate sense or connection with these figures. So I'll talk a bit about that as well. So the figure we're looking at tonight, she's really here. Her job is to entice us to delve completely into the unknown. And she's a sort of emissary. She represents the forces and an energy that we can access, when we move away from what is familiar into something less familiar, into chaos. So moving maybe from the comfort of life, the comforts that life offers us, security, seeming security, and we engage with things that we don't understand, things that we don't know. They're happening all the time, but we don't always encounter them. We don't always want to encounter them. So the chaos is what's beneath the rational mind. It's what's beneath our conventional behaviours, our socially acceptable little package of ourselves that we've kind of negotiated as we've grown up. We've learned what people want us to do, and we know what we want sort of to, so we sort of create a sort of acceptable way of getting enough of what we want and having people like us and blah, blah, blah. So that kind of works in a sort of way, doesn't it? But underneath that there's loads of other stuff going on, and we know this from Jung and other psychoanalysts and therapists, people who are interested in the unconscious mind. They're picking this stuff up and looking at it and going, what is this, what's really happening? So the figure that we're looking at tonight, the generic terminology is a Dakini, and she is a female figure, and very, very rich, multifaceted figure, loads of layers of meaning. I'm not going to be able to sort of go through it all tonight. I just want to see if we can get into the spirit of what Dakinis might represent. So there's a generic word, Dakini, And that name comes from a Sanskrit root meaning space or direction or sky. So we can think of the Dakini as a sky dancer or a sky walker or a space traveller. Another word, poetic translation is celestial maiden. Okay, so the Dakini is a female figure. It's a female figure. There is the male word, the masculine word is darker, and darkers don't have such a significant representational, as far as I know. They don't appear so centrally within the Buddhist tradition, the particular tradition that we're looking at. So a Dakini is a generic word, and then within the world of Dakinis, there are myriad Dakinis, and some have got names and some haven't. So we'll be looking a little bit at that today, the different types of Dakini. So she can have quite basic psychological meaning. She can have a mythological meaning, and she can also have transcendental meanings. So we'll see how those relate to each other. So a Dakini, Yeah, so we've got this space dancer. And here she is. And brought this translation, space dancer, sky dancer, celestial maiden, is depicting is this uninhibited figure. So space meaning every direction, meaning almost. There's so many directions you can go into in space that it's almost the word direction doesn't even mean anything. It's this total liberation, even from the thought of directions. That's the kind of space in which she travels. Okay, so we're talking about a huge amount of energy, and the Dakini can appear to us or can appear in Buddhist tradition as forces to be tamed. Okay, so. Forces to be tamed, subdued, and taken onto the path. Okay, so in the first half, when David Mitchell was introducing the meditation, and he's saying, you know, don't worry if you're feeling more positive than you were, then your meditation's working. Also, don't worry if you're not. If you've uncovered a load of difficult emotion, this also happens. If you've uncovered things that you didn't know about yourself that you'd rather not look at, this is also very, very helpful because you're uncovering things, you're uncovering energy, you're uncovering parts of yourself that don't fit into this negotiated personality that you've created to operate in the world. And these parts are really exciting. If we can look at them and look at them very honestly and frankly, then we can make something of them. We can bring them on board. So this is what the Dakini can represent. So some representations of Dakinis are quite horrific, quite ugly. And this has been very interesting for me because In my Buddhist life, I've always been attracted to beauty, beautiful figures. And I remember hearing about people who practiced in front of figures that maybe had, what was one of them? She's got a pig on her head, and they wear bones, and they've got skulls around their necks. And so this is fascinating to me. So why would you do that? Why would you look at something so ugly? And of course, we need to look at that. We need to look at what's ugly. It can help us. So this starting with this sense of what we don't want to look at, what is unknown within our own psyche, can help us. And this is the sort of ugliest Darkeni figures. Maybe they've got animal heads. Sometimes they ride on jackals. There's one who carries her own severed head under her arm. Trying to think of something. Yeah, they might have bird heads, or they ride on elephant balls, or they're quite skeletal, or some of them are quite old. And there's a sort of riotous, celebratory feel to these ugly figures of this energy that we can use. And our teacher, Sangharakshita, says, what this means is that spiritual life is not a sort of anemic, flat, saintly affair, okay? So it's about the throbbing energy that we can access in our passions, okay? The Darkeni can, so it can represent our sort of most primordial passions. It can also represent the muse. And then, as I said, it can also represent the transcendental. So it can even, she can even appear as a Buddha figure. So direct representation of, or as direct as any appearance can be, of enlightenment, of enlightenment enlightened consciousness. And at all these levels, I'll explore them a bit more. There's a common denominator, and that is that the Darkeni's total indifference to our mundane opinion of her. Okay, she doesn't care what we think. Okay, so that's why on the shrine we've got two different representations of Darkeni's, and everything is on show. Okay, so after the class, do have a go and go have a look. She's totally naked, and this is unusual in. Well, it's very unusual to have that much exposure in artwork. She's totally naked. She doesn't care. It's not that she is a rebel. She's not rebelling against convention. This is where we mustn't get confused. She's not defiant. She's just completely indifferent to our conventional small, the smallness of the conventional world. So, for instance, her ornamentation is bones, not jewels. She, you know, has no need to decorate herself with jewels. One of the things about the importance of accessing these energies, these primordial, so-called primordial energies, which sort of come out, we can recognise them in moods, okay? So moods, we can't really decide what mood. It's very, very hard to decide what mood to be in, isn't it? Like if you're in a bad mood, it doesn't feel like we woke up and said, oh, do you know what, today I'll be in a bad mood. It just feels like it just sort of come out of nowhere. Of course, as Buddhist practitioners, we know that we do make choices that can help avoid bad moods. But yeah, we can experience, we all know what it is to have different moods, passions. And if we don't look at them, so it's not even that if we don't look at them, we'll just lead a constricted sort of life and it will be okay. They'll actually just keep trying to thwart us. They will keep thwarting us. If we don't look at these kinds of things, if we don't look at what's happening with our bad moods, you know, what's the source of it, what's going on with us. If we don't look at that, if we don't look at our propensity to anger, then it will just keep popping its head up, and it will thwart us. It will get in the way of any sense of progress. So the Darkeni figure is inviting us to open this up. Okay, and it, we have to do it in the right place, the right time. And I think it's quite hard for us to access this kind of intensity of energy, because we do so much in our lives that dissipates energy. And I think this is really, really a sort of a major danger in our life, in our lifestyle. I think technology and busyness and the ability to distract ourselves by gratification after gratification, minute after minute, just it covers up the fact that we have these kind of energies. It covers them up, and we just fritter it away. So we're with our material riches, we're blocking out a whole array of other riches if we're not careful, if we don't manage that part of our lives, you know, really, really mindfully, actually. So dissipated energy will never lead to an encounter with the darkening. So you can choose, actually. You might think, well, I perhaps don't want to encounter a darkening. I'll just go on Facebook. She might be there, though. She's probably pretty cunning. Yeah. So where do we encounter the darkening? Where do we encounter her? Well, the traditional place is any kind of intensive situation, and talking about something really crucial where we can't wriggle out of strong feelings, strong responses. This intensive situation, crucial situation, will have the characteristic of some situation where we can't avoid overriding our natural resistances or our preferences. That, you know, those we won't be able to get our preference. Things won't be going our way for whatever reason. And symbolically, and actually literally, the traditional place is the cremation ground. So Buddhist practitioners since the time of the Buddha, I think, have been meditating in cemeteries, cremation grounds, as a way to have a concrete and direct experience with, of course, of death. And this is regarded as a very, very positive thing. So it's a positive thing because done in the right way, done with enough positivity and self-assurance, looking concretely at our own fate gives us an accurate picture of our own situation. An accurate picture of our own situation will always have an element of positivity in it. If it doesn't have a sense of choice or creativity in responding to that, then it isn't an accurate picture. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Can you unpack that a bit?
What's
not sure?
You're not sure
if that's 100% so.
You
maybe that's my problem.
No, I'm just wondering what how to answer your questions. That's my duty.
Just sounds like quite a strong statement. But here we are.
Yeah. Okay, so my statement was that if there isn't a sense of positivity somewhere in our assessment of a situation, then it's not an accurate picture. So as what I mean by that is that positive mental states are skillful mental states, positive mental states, whatever they may look like. And grief is not, it can be a positive mental state, so we're not talking about happy mental states. Of course, that includes happy mental states. Positive mental states are in line with reality. They're in line with how things are. Negative mental states include complete defeatism, nihilism, self-absorption, greed, hatred and delusion. And they are not in line with how things are. So, if we really realise what death means, then there is, and people talk about this a lot when they're, you know, closely faced with death, there's a sort of liberation, an understanding of what life is actually like, what life actually is, and the importance, the preciousness of human life. So that's what I mean. Does that make sense?
I realise what I was getting at. If you're terrified, is that okay?
Terrified or?
Well, you're in the charnel ground. It's spooky. It's the middle of the night. Anything could happen. Is that useful?
Yes.
I'm not sure how one could not be terrified.
Well, some people wouldn't be terrified.
Well, what?
Okay, so.
When one first went, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that positive? Or could it be? Because it sounds like a sort of natural response.
Yeah.
Even a healthy one, I don't know.
I think what practitioners, and it's not just Buddhist practitioners actually who go into the cremation grounds, are basically they're working to overcome their fear of death, and this is what the Buddha did the Fear and Dread Sutta. He paced up and down the jungle and looked fear in the eyes, and he just said, whatever fears arise, I'm going to carry on doing what I'm doing. I'm going to be meditating as I'm sitting, walking down. And by doing that, he overcame fear. Okay, so, and this is, I think, probably what you, maybe you're getting at, Sasanajoti, is that there will be fear in looking at death and going to the charnel ground and is a very, very strong way to look at that fear and look at it in its proper context. And earlier when I was talking about it, I said, and to look at our inevitable fate, and I was thinking that fate's quite a good word. Sometimes we're a bit afraid to use the word fate, because it means that maybe things have been pre-designed, but actually death is our fate. It's almost, we might as well just say we're already dead. It's so inevitable. We're already dead, all of us here. I'm here to tell you, we're already dead. And if we really know that, then what trivial things would we drop away from? What would we sort of let go of in our lives? What trivial things would we do with let go of? We're already dead, and what's the point of clinging? Okay. And so the Dakini figure, this dancing sky dancer, can represent that kind of energy released, the dropping away of trivia, the ignoring of custom, of small actions, of small thinking. And that's why it's thought that for those of a sturdy enough constitution, meditating in the cremation ground is is such a healthy, a positive thing to do. And by doing that, you're sacrificing the known, aren't you, for the unknown. So we think we know what life is, so we have to look at death. We have to look at death in order to sculpt. Actually, I'm not going to say that sentence. I've said it all. Yeah. So, what if we're not going to go to the cemetery in the night and look at bones and decomposing corpses? What other crucial situations are going to work? Well, sometimes sometimes they just happen to us, don't they? The nature of life is so precarious. Things just happen to us, and many of us will have felt that. Things don't go our own way. So sometimes we don't need to go looking for the charnel ground. Things just happen. We lose people. We lose what we want. We invest in things. And suddenly it's taken away. And we'd give anything to have it back. We'd give anything, but we can't have it back. That sort of situation, if it's treated right, if it's treated with awareness and embraced as a teaching, then that can be the charnel ground, the cremation ground. And of course those things can happen to us, and they're not cremation grounds because we don't ask them to be. So we don't look at them as teachings. We just want to hide from them, or it becomes too difficult, or we allow difficult experiences to embitter us. If we don't do that, if we don't let difficult experiences embitter us or become part of a story about ourselves and why the world isn't treated us right or whatever happens, if we don't do that, then there's a huge amount of creativity, and we can turn towards that suffering, whatever kind of loss, however big or small, and we will grow. We will grow. That will happen. We just have to attend to it. And sometimes even if we're looking for more crucial situation, there's lots of things we can do. We can maybe we can take on lots more we can take on more responsibility. Something that we didn't think we could do, we can try and do it. And by doing that, we have to take that leap into the unknown, don't we? And we might, hopefully, doing that, we discover we have to dig into new resources within ourselves, do things in new ways, and discover that we're much more capable than we thought. There's much more to us than we thought there was. Many Buddhists try and create intensive situations by working together, living together. Some people work and live together. You know, that can be working and living together with your friends. That's pretty intense, actually. There's times when your friends won't be your friends. You've got to keep looking at it. You've got to keep with it. You can't move away. You can't just sort of slide out. If you want the cremation ground, you can't just sort of sidle off and go somewhere else and relax. You have to keep with it and see always what's arising and what's happening. Yeah.
Just a little question.
Yeah.
It almost sounds like you should pursue it. So is it almost like be antagonising for the sake of antagonising and create this charnel ground situation? It's almost like do you let it happen, or do you run away from it, or do you run at it? Because they're like, I don't know if running at it might be the best thing. Trying to get to those environments and creating this intense life, or, you know.
So I don't advocate I don't advocate getting into loads of arguments or being antagonistic. I think it's a good question. So I think one of the things about this is it's a really, really personal. I think the Darkani, the figure of the Darkani, is a very impersonal, very personal figure. So she arrives, if she arrives, she's here for you, and she's like, here, now, do it, okay? That's the kind of, she's got this kind of urgency, nowness to her. And it means that everybody's situation is different, and everyone probably... Sometimes you might feel like you want to make changes in your life where things that you know aren't being addressed can be addressed. So that's one way of running at it. You might think, actually, my life is very, very comfortable. I live on my own. I get things my own way a lot. This is just an example, okay? So I'm not going to tell you all what to do. I don't think I am. And you might think it's very, very comfortable, but there's something unsatisfactory about it. Yeah, so you got this feeling of like, maybe there's more to life. So that's where you could run at it. You could put yourself in situations where you're not going to have any choice but to look at new aspects of yourself. I think that's what I mean. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Or just be scared of like maybe the dangers of running into some other situations.
Yeah. No. And don't do it foolishly. Choose wisely. Choose do it with other people who are doing similar things, who are interested in that journey. Mm.
Is it useful here just to suggest she's non-violent in the fullest sense of that term?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas quite often, when we confront things, there seems to be an element of, you know, something adversarial.
No, I think that's right.
Say she's completely non-violent. You know?
Yeah. Oh, she has no need for violence.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Although it's. It's quite violent imagery, so
yeah.
some of the imagery of the Darkani, she'll be bearing weapons. The one up there, she's actually got a kind of Cupid's bow and arrow, so it's a floral bow and arrow. So she had there's a martial weapon there, and they carry vajra choppers very often. So that the imagery can seem quite violent, but of course any enlightened, any figure coming, representing enlightenment is only doing that for expedient reasons. They're not inherently violent, spiteful, aggressive. They're just doing what needs to be done. So, yeah. Yeah. I'm just going to talk a bit about the Darkani as muse now, which I mentioned earlier, or Darkani as inspiration. And the muse, let's look at the time, okay. The muse in the Western tradition is quite similarly depicted, or there's a sort of sense of the muse being a female creative person that we can open up to. It's something else that we can open up to. Something other that can, if we arrange ourselves correctly, can come through us. Okay, so in classical civilization, the muse is often invoked at the beginning of long poetic works and things like that. So it's almost as if it's not me, I need help from the muse. Okay, so. And in many stories, from the Darkani figure is from the Indian and Tibetan tradition. And in many stories, she may appear in that way, as sort of inspiration, with a new... a new proposal or a vision or a prophecy or something like that. So she may appear in dreams, and she could be many different colours. There's blue, black, green, dark, and these. Milarepa was a Tibetan practitioner, yogi, and he had a vision. He had a dream of a green Dakini with golden hair, and she represented his deepest inspiration, and actually predicted the next stage of his life. You had to read the prediction, the symbols, quite carefully, but she was predicting taking on a disciple, his best, most able disciple. And I just thought, when I was thinking about this, I thought of something I'd read about Picasso, so I'm going to talk about Picasso now. In his youth, well, from a very young age, Picasso was trained in classical drawing. So he was given a very rigorous art education from his father. And the drawings, I don't know if anyone's ever seen Picasso's juvenile drawings, they're extremely, extremely good. I mean, some people think that Picasso couldn't draw, but he was a virtuoso by the time he was 12. Wonderful drawer. And he understood the tradition, but as he grew up, he felt constrained by it. And you can see this, he's working through different styles of art. So he's working through whatever's contemporary. He's doing it for a bit, and then it's not the right mode of expression. There's something urging through. And to keep those modes of using those techniques would have been constraining. Okay, so almost like living a cliche, or wearing someone else's clothes. So it wasn't going to work. So he saw in Paris, he saw an exhibition of African art, and he said it had a profound effect on him. So he saw these masks and sculptures, and he felt for something very strongly. And whether that was in the African art or not, it had an effect on Picasso. He said they were against everything, against unknown threatening spirits. So he really felt that there was a huge potency in these sculptures, and he resonated with them. He said, "I understood, I too am against everything. I believe that everything is unknown, that everything is an enemy." Okay, so he suddenly saw this sense of division between his interior and the exterior, and this tension. Do you see this this tension of the unknown? And he tackled it in his painting. And the painting that he produced as a result of this was called Damoiselles d'Avignon, and it was a revolutionary painting. It depicts five naked women in a brothel, with distorted, broken up air surfaces, interlocking surfaces, mask-like faces, and in one corner, that the women, the two of the women, have got extremely strong African mask-like faces, and there's defiance, and there's almost aggression in these women and the posture. And so it's not just the subject of these women, but the fact that Picasso pushed through and he invented a new language in Western painting, and it's described as being actually a rupture. It's described as being a rupture between the old way of painting and the new. And this is a kind of metaphor for what the Dakini and Buddhist practice can represent. Okay, so this intensive training, intensive discipline, which pays attention to everything. It doesn't just do the discipline for the sake of discipline. It pays attention to that urge which is trying to find expression. And suddenly, and maybe very, very inconveniently, something is going to break through. Very, very inconveniently, because it doesn't fit what we already were or what we thought we were. And Picasso hung his picture against the wall. His friends thought it was a disaster, but later, of course, it's had a massive influence and a huge response, critical acclaim. And the discipline that Dakini represents, of course, is a discipline of meditation. And she is highly moral, so she's never immoral, but her morality doesn't fit with what idea of morality is. So we're not going to be able to predict what she will do, but she's highly moral. And the discipline of practicing ethics and meditation will create this new unimaginable, unforeseeable energy, freedom. So now, so we've talked a bit about the more grotesque Dakinis, so the Dakinis with the severed heads and riding jackals, these dark kind of untrammeled forces within us. And we talked a bit about the Dakini as muse. And I'm going to read some descriptions from our teacher, Sangharakshita, describing Dakinis. The freedom of the Dakini. And he says that, as we've already seen, empty space represents absence of obstruction and therefore freedom of movement. If space is absolutely empty, you can move freely in it in any direction. So the Dakini or Daka symbolizes complete freedom and movement. This is, of course, not literal movement within space. And this is important. Space or sky also represents mind in its absolute aspect. So the Dakinis represent the free moving energies of the mind itself. They are the thrills and tremors of emotional energy that pass through the mind, bubbling up from its very depths. When I was looking for representations of the Dakini, I don't have any myself, and there was one who's quite well known called Vajra Yogini, and I wanted to get a picture of her, but I haven't been able to. I think the reason I wanted to get the picture of her is because she's so well known and she's quite recognisable, and you might see her in other places, so I just wanted to acquaint you with her. And I'm just going to talk about some of the symbolism, and it appears with some of these figures too, of Vajra Yogini. So Vajra Yogini is Dakini as Buddha figure. So she is a figure where all of these incoherent and primordial energies have undergone the discipline of a Dharma life. They've undergone the discipline of a Dharma life, and they are released into this figure who is completely abandoned. Her abandonment isn't in a kind of intoxicated state. She just can throw herself into the three jewels, absolute abandonment to the three jewels, to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. and her freedom is of that nature. And that's the freedom that everything, all of our different parts of us actually yearn for. We can't be satisfied by anything else. So this figure, Vajrayogini, represents the bliss of that ultimate destination, ultimate manifestation. Vajrayogini is red in colour, and we could think about the symbolism. Actually, I'm just going to ask you, what might a red figure represent?
Passion.
Passion, yeah, very good. Yeah. Anything else? What else does red?
Blood.
Yeah, blood. So passion, blood.
Anger.
Anger, yeah. Yeah, and anger is a kind of passion, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, that, so we've got, I think that's right. Anger, we see red, but also the colour of desire is red, isn't it? So we've got both of those, the energies of both of those. And what, anything else come to mind when we're thinking about?
Energy.
Okay, so red is a very vibrant, energetic colour. Yeah, yeah.
Love.
Love, yeah, yeah, indeed, yeah.
What about fire?
Fire, yeah, yeah. And that goes with energy, doesn't it? Yeah. What else? What if you go, red, what does that mean?
Embarrassment.
Embarrassment, yeah. Sunburn. Yeah, embarrassment, which I also think is interesting, a sort of blush. And Vajrayogini, so she's red, she's got all the associations with the colour red. She's like these two figures. She's a dancing figure, and she has a string of skulls around her neck. I think the top figure, I don't know who the top figure is, she also has a string of skulls around her neck. It's not because she's bloodthirsty, it's because, well, what we can imagine, this adornment of skulls, we can think of it as representing no longer having passed through many, many lifetimes in samsara and no longer needing that, free from rebirth. Or we could think of it also as just a death of succession of selves, a death of a succession of selves. Why might that be a good thing? Death of a succession of selves. Does that sound good to people? Or weird? Burning off negative, yeah, exactly, yeah. So creating more positive karma, yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, yeah. Any other thoughts about that?
You learn a lot from you if you have lost lives. So you'd progress.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So hope, I mean, you might not learn a lot. That is the risk. Most, you know... The cyclical version of samsara is the one where we're not learning.
Right.
The one where the death, where we're embracing this sense of not being able to cling to that which we want to identify ourselves by, one where we actually gain wisdom by that. That version of samsara is the way that we can escape it. It's I'm doing this. This is a sort of meant to imply the spiral where we can ascend from this circle where we go round and round forever forever means. Vajrayogini, she drinks from a skull cup, and she drinks this red liquid that looks like blood. Also, it's not blood; it's a nectar, but it looks like blood because, well, what is said is that it's it's ever for refilling, replenishes itself. This cup, she is nourished by the blood of the spiritual life. and it's a nectar that gives great bliss. Okay, so she's, the Dakini is in ecstasy, she's in bliss for having this sense of liberation, for having this liberation. And her mind being in total harmony with reality creates this bliss. And you can see, afterwards you'll be able to see, she often is trampling on a figure, and that figure is representing ignorance. So she tramples on ignorance, she has no need for it. And in some figures, the Dakini has a mirror in her head where she will be, she's into shock factors, the Dakini figure. She's not a subtle teacher. If you hadn't started to get the idea, she's not a subtle teacher. She's probably not going to be one of these ones who sort of hands you a flower and you're meant to guess what the meaning is. She's got a pig on her head and she's drinking blood, and she's and she's got a mirror, and it's going to show you exactly what's happening, and it's going to it's not going to distort anything, and that's going to be a shock as well. So those are some of the symbols. And she's naked because she has nothing to hide. She's just naked, unmediated, unveiled reality. That's what this represents. She's got nothing to hide. No shame, no need for covering. I think talking about the Dakini often comes with a bit of a warning. It's not something that you try and invoke without really meaning it. If you ask for the Dakini and she comes and you ignore it, she won't come again. You know, she's not going to waste her time. She's offering you something very drastic. Often. And when I say drastic, it might not even be big. It might just be a little thing. It might just be a new way of looking at things in your own lives. It might just be a new way of responding to people. It might be suddenly saying, do you know what, I'm not going to let that person speak to me anymore, because I don't need to be the kind of person that people speak to like that. You know, it might be something like that. It could be just a little reorientation in your life. It could be quite small, but it's going to be definite. It's going to be definite. It's going to be personal, and it's going to be insistent, a slightly disruptive force. So yeah, just be careful. And the times that I feel like I've been in presence or encountered the Dakini haven't been in London. They've been when I've gone on solitary retreat and I've come away. It's not even that I thought, oh, here's the Dakini, but afterwards I thought, oh yeah, I've got to do something a bit different. And it feels like I've got, and it's going to take a bit of courage to do that. That's my personal relationship with the Dakini figure. We've just got a few minutes, so I'm just going to ask if there are any questions around.
Is she also holding the chopper?
Vajrayogini.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about what she does?
I'm going to ask some questions from other people first. Okay. Thanks.
Do you find they come when called, or do they work their own schedule?
Yeah. In my experience, it's been their own schedule. Yeah, but people do deliberately, I guess they work to their own schedule, but you can, like I was saying, talking about creating situations where you do really want to learn something, or you do really want to change something, look at habits, and creating situations where you have no choice to do that. That's a kind of invocation. Yeah. Mm. Any other questions? Yeah.
You referred it then to things like chaos and the unknown and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And in listening, it sounded, it'd be lovely to have somebody with you when you're facing the fear of chaos, the fear of the unknown.
Mm.
Is this the sort of character of imagery that's sort of supposed to help you in that sort of space? I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that.
Oh, what a guide to help you, a guide to help you navigate the unknown.
Yeah.
It's more.
Sit with you while you face that. Right.
She might inspire you to do that. Yeah. She's not going to be a tranquil, hand-holding figure. So sometimes we do need that. That's something much more serene. If it's happened, if life is tough, sometimes we might need something more serene to help us. She's not that kind of figure, but she might inspire us to embrace the difficulties, that she represents that, I think. Yeah. Yeah. And she also can represent friendship, so she can just be a companion that awakens our energy. So I didn't get around to saying that. So she can just be a companion that sort of sparks us off, enlivens us. It's not all about the rough road. It can be just an extremely creative, pleasurable experiences of just being alive. Yeah. Does that bring up any other questions? Oh, yeah.
Just to go back a little bit, when you said that we're all like essentially dead at the moment, could you expand on that a little bit?
I suppose, I can't sort of logically say it, it's just a sensation that I have, that it's so inevitable and our lives are so short compared to the infinite. It's just that it's not like I mean it literally that we're actually dead, but it's absolutely inevitable. It's going to come, and we're probably not going to be. It may well come when we don't want it. We might not be ready.
So would that maybe render life itself superfluous then? Like the whole journey of life?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's a really good question, and definitely not. I think it's just so there is going to be an end. We're moving towards it, and I think what I was trying to say is realizing that makes life loads more intense and makes life loads richer. So it is that realizing, knowing. Do you ever do that? Just sometimes just think, on my deathbed, what am I actually going to regret? What am I going to wish I did? So if we know that we're going to die, then we do those things that we wish that we really want to do. We won't forget. We won't forget to do them. We won't forget what's important. Yeah, I think that's what I meant. Yeah.
Does it give life urgency then?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the thing I'm struggling with here is it seems that this is a kind of melting pot. There's some of this, there's some of this, there's some of this, and then it can mean a bit of this, it can mean a bit of that. And depending on when, it can mean different things. To the point where it's almost getting so many, so multifaceted. Like just in the symbolism of kind of red, there's so many meanings that almost it's only there as a symbol to you can see what you wanted it, but then it almost dilutes everything out of it as a symbol.
Okay, yeah, I think that's quite interesting, like that's the problem of explaining symbols, and like if we have an encounter with a symbol, we don't need to go, oh well, it means this and this resonates with that and it reminds me of this and da 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 da. Like a symbol has its own life and its own meaning. You know how dreams just mean what they mean. Sometimes we come away with a feeling from a dream, and we can spend some time analysing it, but we might not get to it because the dream was its own thing. And I think that I think that is the problem. Like it's sometimes helpful to look at what things mean, and especially when some of the symbolism is obscure. And it's going to be personal, and I'm saying lots of things that aren't really clarifying. I suppose to go straight to the point with the red, like in my mind, all of those things are relevant because it's a kind of, it's not like they're all different things, but they're all things that converge around this colour, and they express a kind of life force within it.